The Virtual Curbside is a production of the Utah Chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics, the Utah AAP, working together to improve children's lives through education, advocacy, and networking. Hi, this is Paul Workus from the Utah AAP. Welcome to this week's edition of the Virtual Curbside, where we bring pediatric providers together with subspecialists to get smarter about all things pediatric and better acquainted as a community of caregivers. Welcome back to the Virtual Curbside. This is our monthly episode 4, where we get to ask our speaker all the questions that we've gotten from our episodes for the month so far. And by the way, thanks for all your questions and feedback. The Virtual Curbside is brought to you in part by a generous grant from Primary Children's Hospital. Primary Children's Hospital, the child, first and always. Welcome back to the Virtual Curbside. We're very fortunate to be able to have Shelley Lawrence back with us today to take your questions. Shelley, first of all, welcome back.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be here, Paul.
It's been a lot. It's interesting because this is one where I've actually, you know, as I've talked to friends and colleagues, there's been some chatter about this, partly because I think that these are surprising topics in some ways, and things that I think we in some ways thought were historical topics when we learned about them in medical school, at least some of us.
Oh, I agree. And syphilis is one of those topics that's hard to learn. And truly, if you understand it, you're probably above your time in medicine. So it's one of those things everybody thought it was never going to, you know, recur. So, you know, it's one of those things you learn, take your test, and maybe dump the day after.
Right. Yeah, you know, it's interesting because one of the things that was interesting to me in medical school is we would learn things and it felt like everything had the same weight. And then once you got into a clinical time, you realized that things sorted themselves out. And some of those things that I spent a lot of time memorizing never came up again. But syphilis is clearly something with very important consequences that we really need to understand.
Agreed. And, you know, most of what we know about syphilis was learned back in the 1900s. You know, the test we're currently using is based on knowledge of 150 years ago. I mean, what's scary about syphilis is because the numbers dwindled to the lowest amounts at the beginning of the new millennium, there was no money in research. So, you know, now all the researchers that actually know syphilis and understand its intricacies are going to start retiring, and there's not a pipeline to take up that fight. So how are we going to get better testing? How are we going to get better diagnoses? And my gosh, what happens if it at some point becomes resistant to penicillin? You know, these are all very scary questions, as its resistance to macrolides like azithromycin is so high. But yeah, this is one that might keep me up sometimes at night.
Yeah, in an era especially where competition for research dollars and availability of research dollars is tricky sometimes, taking on what may seem like either to some people not a timely topic or an unpopular topic becomes more difficult, I think.
I agree. And you know, the problem with syphilis is there was such a high infant death before we had neonatology specialties and NICU. So if you really consider neonatology being a relatively new field of medicine since the 1980s, you know, late 1970s, we didn't see a lot of these kids. So now these kids are surviving that would once die. And we have no idea what to tell the parents about what their outcomes are going to be.
We were talking offline just before we started. Apparently there's some news about syphilis incidents in Salt Lake County.
Yes. So the CDC is always a year behind in numbers. So the 2022 CDC numbers were released here recently. And in Utah, Salt Lake County, as well as St. George, supersedes the 2030 Healthy People guidelines of 4.6 per thousand reproductive age women that are being diagnosed with primary and secondary syphilis. So that officially puts these two counties in Utah in a very high incident region that would then trigger the three-point testing and more testing.
It makes this topic even more timely. Well, let's dive into our questions. Before we begin, would you like to talk about your disclosures again?
Yes. So my only disclosure is I'm a co-founder of a company called Milio Labs, which aims to create a diagnostic for broad pathogen detection. My affiliation with Milio Labs is not relevant to our conversation that we're going to have today.
Terrific. Well, let's dive right into the questions. First question comes from Dr. I apologize if I mispronounce this, Andre Rochowski from Ottawa, Canada. First of all, thanks for listening. Second of all, thanks for your great question. So his question is, once in a while, we encounter a mom without any prenatal care who presents to our birth unit in active labor. Assuming her pregnancy history is unremarkable and we have no records, given that a Schenker can be unnoticed, are you advocating we screen all those newborns, even if asymptomatic, for syphilis with the CBC liver enzymes and long bone x-rays?
So I do appreciate the question because we do see a lot of drop-ins on a regular basis, but I would still say you need to start with the mother. So if a mother drops in and doesn't have any prenatal labs, it's not just syphilis we need to worry about, it's HIV, hepatitis B. You know, these are all other infectious diseases that we have appropriate good therapies for to prevent the spread of those diseases to the infant. So I would say that I'm not advocating for you to start with the infant per se, but to start with the mother and send those drop-in labs. If you're doing an RPR, you should probably also reflex to a TPPA to make sure that both of those are negative. If those are both negative, the baby's still, like any healthy newborn or appearing healthy newborn, should have a good history and physical and good follow-up. So even if mom's labs are negative, her and her baby should be followed outpatient to make sure that they don't encounter any other signs of syphilis as that infant grows up.
Of course, one of the challenges there is that if a mother has not had prenatal care, the risk of a baby getting lost to follow-up is increased. How do we cope with that?
Yes, so the Canadian system is probably a little bit different than the U.S. system as far as payment. I really think that these parents really do need to be encouraged to meet those at least early newborn appointments, because they're just so important to make sure that those kiddos' weight is being monitored, that they're growing appropriately and healthy. You know, there's challenges in the United States that I will admit that I don't know how to give the best information about how to get people back into clinics, other than to try to help schedule an appointment before the baby goes, make sure that that appointment is scheduled, and to really just educate the family how important it is to keep these appointments. You know, the other thing is, it's not just syphilis you need to educate this family on. As we talked about the ophthalmia neonatorum, you know, that if mom had no prenatal care and dropped in, it's not just, again, these other infectious diseases that we screen for, but also chlamydia and gonorrhea. So telling the mother, educating her about how important it is that there's things we can see early on in newborns that need follow-up and treatment, because, you know, newborn, we might spend 24 hours, 48 hours in the hospital at the very beginning of their life. They can't give us much of a history sometimes in those 2 days, but as they start to grow up, that might be when some of these processes or others would become apparent that we can intervene on. So I don't know, Paul, maybe you have more guidance, but I know it is challenging to try to get people to always follow up like they're supposed to.
Do you know offhand what the turnaround time would be for an RPR?
Yeah, so in our hospitals, I guess I should say University of Utah, as well as Intermountain Healthcare, the turnaround for an RPR is within 12 hours or so. But if it reflexes to a TPPA, it might take about 24 hours. But these tests are really important to know, as well as the other STIs that we screen for in pregnancy, are really imperative that you know those results before the woman and her baby are discharged from the hospital.
And I'm guessing at a smaller community hospital, those would be sent out somewhere?
They could be sent out somewhere. Everybody should know the turnaround times in their own hospital systems. Many times, though, even if they're sent to a larger institution, the RPRs could be known within a day.
And so to Dr. Ochoski's point, if we truly can't learn anything, then at least heightened surveillance is extremely important there. And that if there are a lot of question marks, that needs to go on our list of things to worry about before sending a baby home, that we know the answers to these before they go home.
I agree, you know, and even delayed discharge. So we do know that if the follow-up is going to be questionable, then that baby should not be discharged by 24 hours. You know, sometimes those are the kids, at least in the United States, that should get a 48-hour surveillance to make sure they are eating well and that we're not missing anything before they go home. So that's another thing to consider, is not to rapidly discharge those families and have a meet with the social worker to make sure that there's not barriers that they might be able to work through to make sure that they get appropriate follow-up for their infant and for themselves.
Just as a side note, it's been fascinating to me to look at the data that we usually, in the not so distant past, we thought of 48 hours as being an adequate amount of time to make sure that we've seen all the things that we need to see. And clearly during the COVID-19 pandemic, it dropped like a rock to 24 hours. And now sometimes it's a challenge to persuade people they need to stay for 24 hours.
Yeah, and if you really think about it, even breastfeeding is not well established. Mom's milk doesn't come in until around day 2 to 3. And by that time, we're kind of removing them from a safe spot in the hospital where there's people in-house, lactation consultant, nurses, et cetera, that I do worry that as that time decreases, not only, I mean, we've seen increases in maternal morbidity and mortality, you know, infant numbers are also increasing in infant mortality and morbidity. I'm not sure we're moving in the right direction.
Well, the good news is we can add this to my list of things that keep me up at night. So I appreciate it.
Yes, agreed.
Next question comes from one of our OB colleagues. Thank you so much for your very systematic presentation. Would there be an advantage to advocating for cesarean delivery in the event of active gonorrhea at presentation or delivery? And how about with active chlamydia?
Yeah, so I think that's a good question. You know, unlike recommendations for mothers that have primary herpes or at least herpes outbreaks at time of delivery, these are not recommended indications, either chlamydia or gonorrhea for a primary cesarean section. The reason being is because we have adequate therapies that we can cover the baby with erythromycin ointment for gonorrhea or give them a dose of ceftriaxone, which is also very highly effective without having to do an operative procedure on the mother. So chlamydia, again, as Paul and I have discussed on multiple occasions, is something that treatment after birth is not necessarily recommended prophylactically or empirically, but if the baby gets symptoms of chlamydia. So I think that doing an operative procedure in the form of a primary cesarean section is not indicated in these two diseases as is supported by the CDC guidelines.
It is fascinating in talking to parents after delivery. Get your appendix out and people watch out for you for a while. You have a baby, that's a very major operation, and your uterus is outside your body for a while, and now you have a baby to take care of. So it's not an inconsiderable burden to put on a parent.
It's actually interesting, Paul, that you bring that up. Remember the days of transition nurseries? Where, you know, it wasn't all mother baby care. Like, I worry, I think number one, it is a good thing to try to keep mom and baby together as much as possible. But when you think about these operative procedures or moms that are really, really, really sick and on medications, she's also expected to be the primary caregiver of her baby while she's in the hospital, even though she sometimes feels terrible or is on a lot of drugs where she may not be completely clear-headed about the care of that baby. In some ways, I wish we would go back to some of the niceties of treating moms with, you know, health conditions that are not conducive to necessarily caring for a newborn on top of it with a little bit more care and guidance in the sense that she's there getting better too. And I don't know, my soapbox, I like mother-baby care under most circumstances. I just wish we had a pop-off for those moms that need a little bit more support.
I just hope the big picture is always informed by kindness and consideration.
Yes.
So let me just summarize for myself. Your last question is that since we have good treatments for even something as terrible as infant gonorrhea, that the treatments are effective enough that it really behooves us to have good early treatment of the baby and surveillance rather than advocating for operative delivery.
Correct. If it's known that mom has an active infection, then that baby should get a dose of ceftriaxone after birth, in addition to erythromycin if it's available. So we know how to treat those babies, but more importantly, follow up.
Okay. And then you touched on our last question. You talked briefly about observation of a baby born to a mother with active chlamydia. What surveillance would you recommend specifically? What should I be thinking about in an infant who may become infected with chlamydia?
Yeah, so I just want to go over again why we don't necessarily treat. And it's because the majority of kids never show symptoms of chlamydia, which would be in the form of the ophthalmia neonatorum, where their eyelids can swell and have some watery discharge, or the pneumonia that can set in when they're a little bit older. So the treatment that we give, erythromycin, can cause other problems in babies. It can cause the pyloric sphincter at the end of the stomach to hypertrophy, and they can get pyloric stenosis, which then would be a surgical therapy in most kids. So that's the reason we don't treat for chlamydia.
By that, you mean systemic erythromycin as opposed to the ointment?
Well, yes. So the oral form of erythromycin, yes. So that's why we don't routinely treat all the kids with erythromycin that have been exposed potentially to chlamydia. But for, you know, the Neisseria gonorrhea, those kids are going to present in the first couple of days of life, usually between day 2 and day 5, where the chlamydia exposed kids might be identified a little bit later, around a week to 2. Again, I think it's just important to really tell the parents, you know, these are the things you need to look out for: any eye swelling, eye drainage. This baby needs to go back and see me right away, or at least have a plan in place. So parents know what to watch for. You know, usually I tell parents, you know, Spider-Man has his spidey senses. And when they tingle, he knows something's wrong, like danger is imminent. And we all have those spidey senses as well, and mothers in particular. So if your spidey senses are tingling because something doesn't feel right, you really do need to call your pediatrician. And when those moms call, or the dads call the pediatrician because their spidey senses are tingling, they really need to be taken seriously, and the baby needs to be evaluated.
What about chlamydia pneumonia? How does that typically present, and when?
Yeah, so the chlamydia pneumonia is a little bit different. It can present a couple of weeks after birth. And usually these kiddos are going to show up as respiratory signs, you know, increased respiratory rate. They can be hypoxic upon examination. Initially, babies don't cough real well, but as they get a little bit older, then they can develop a cough. So these kids are going to be those that show up with signs of respiratory distress.
Very helpful. Anything else you want to share with us? This has been very helpful.
Yeah, no, it's a pleasure to be on the podcast and be able to talk about these topics that are near and dear to my heart, especially as they're rising in case numbers. But therapies are sometimes really beginning to get harder to get, like the penicillin and bicillin. You know, even though we're increasing in incidence, you know, it's harder to get treatments and they're more expensive. So somehow we're going to have to try to work through that as a society.
Let's see. So high rates of syphilis and gonorrhea, and penicillin doesn't exist. So clearly we're living in the 19th century.
It appears so, right? I mean, I guess I would say that, thank goodness, after all the time that we've been exposed to syphilis. So I think I might've mentioned, like, the Neanderthal man that they uncovered had signs of bone changes associated with potential syphilis. Like, despite the fact that it's been with us for so long, and the only thing we've had to really use against it is penicillin. I mean, I think we should thank our lucky stars that it's still very sensitive to penicillin.
Right.
But I think that as it's exposed more and more and more, you always have to wonder, will resistance happen?
And now, like, we just have to,
with the macrolides.
Given supply chain issues, I think we have to thank our lucky stars when we have penicillin available.
That is correct. And again, to really consider, if you're, you know, everybody should know what their drug shortages are. And if you're in an area of potential bicillin shortage, to consider preserving that for infants and women that are pregnant, and really making sure that we use alternative means like doxycycline for those that can take it safely.
Sounds great. Thanks so much, Shelly. Hope we can have you back sometime. I wish you all the best, and thanks for your time and your expertise.
Yeah, and I'll just mention, I'm always available. I don't mind if you give out my email, but you know, anytime anybody has a question about these topics, I'd love to be able to be available.
Terrific. We'll put it in the show notes. Thanks everyone for listening. Please tell your friends and family to listen too, because, you know, what could be better? We'll look forward to talking again next week.
Thanks for joining us. We look forward to getting together again next time. The Virtual Curbside is available on iTunes or wherever you find your other favorite podcasts. Be sure to like us and subscribe. We want you to like us both because we're needy that way, and because that will help other listeners like you find us. Check out our website, vcurb.com, for supporting materials, schedules, and other great stuff. The Virtual Curbside is an educational production of the Utah chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. The opinions expressed in this podcast, while carefully considered, are ultimately the opinions of the presenters and not necessarily of the American Academy of Pediatrics or our employers. And remember, The content of this podcast shouldn't be seen as a substitute for seeking actual personal medical care. If this is an emergency, hang up and dial 911. Otherwise, schedule a visit with a caring healthcare provider to try to get to the bottom of your concerns. None of this could happen without Elisa Stoddard, our extraordinary executive director of the Utah AAP. Many thanks to Tim Cosgrove for his help on the website and logo design. Production design and editing thanks to Phil Workus, who also composed the theme music. See you next time.